Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, I'm Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer. According to Harper's Magazine, aid intended for Afghanistan is winding back here in the United States in the hands of non-governmental organizations and charities smart enough to get contracts through the United States Agency for International Development. The information is all laid out in an infographic or maybe a map and text-tacular, whatever you want to call it. It's there in Harper's Magazine. And Ken Silverstein is the man who did all the research documenting where the aid is going. Hello, Ken.
Hi.
So you cite a 2005 report which said that 86% of the aid to Afghanistan was phantom aid, meaning it never gets into the country. Why not?
Well, let me first say that this is part of a bigger problem. It's not just Afghanistan. Typically, most U.S. aid ends up in the pockets of American consultants and American companies because the intent of aid has always, historically, it's been to basically to enrich American companies. I mean, it's, you know, the old aphorism about charity begins at home. I mean, we talk about development aid and we talk about how we're going to, you know, help countries develop. But it turns out that almost all the money, that's going too far, but certainly well over half of American aid usually ends up back in the pockets of American companies. And so Afghanistan, which I focused on because, you know, for obvious reasons, we have this ongoing war there, and it's a country we invaded following 9/11, and we promised to develop it so it would never again be a haven for terrorism. Afghanistan is just a classic example. You just see where time after time, instead of distributing the aid money to local companies and to firms that are better positioned to do the work, it goes to these big beltway bandit firms who, you know, don't know what they're doing. They don't know Afghanistan, and they spend far more than they should. There's just, you know, boondoggle after boondoggle. And so instead of developing Afghanistan, we're really undermining the occupation by misspending money and creating a lot of resentment in Afghanistan about...
Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but go ahead, finish your thought.
No, just there's a lot of resentment from what I have heard in Afghanistan about, you know, you've got these contractors over there living the high life, and all of this alleged spending and charity by America from the United States government, and it's not doing a lot of good. They're spending far more than they should on schools and clinics, and, you know, there have been a series of disasters, and it's making people angry.
Now, you started that answer by saying that the aid that America wastes isn't only in Afghanistan, but I wanted to point out that it's not only America wasting aid, and I'm citing ActionAid, which was the 2005 group that did the study about how much aid was phantom aid. The report says that all development aid given by all countries worldwide, only 40% is real and the rest is phantom aid. But Afghanistan seems to be a place where there's more phantom aid than anywhere else. Is it just because of the historically and legendary ungovernable nature of Afghanistan?
No, I don't think it's because of that. I think it's because there's been so much money that's poured in. It's about $8 billion since 2002. So, one, you just have this enormous flow of money into the country. And, B, you've had, over the last 10 years or so, the decimation of USAID as a development organization. The staff has been shrunk. The budgets have been cut. They can't even oversee the projects that they're supposed to be implementing over there. So you've got a lot of money and very little oversight, and firms that really are not qualified to be doing the work they're contracted to do, or certainly they're not as well qualified as local firms. And in fact, frequently what we see is that American companies are getting huge contracts, and then they are hiring local Afghan firms and paying them a fraction of what they receive to do the work. So you have cases of this time and time again.
Sometimes they hire Bangladeshi or Indian middlemen and paying them maybe higher than what they'd pay the Afghanistanis, but less than they'd pay an American.
Exactly. So, you know, I mean, if you're going to distribute money, why not distribute it directly to the company that's going to do the work instead of giving it to American firms, which are just skimming large sums off the top? And a lot of these firms, incidentally, were created strictly to get government contracts. I mean, they don't have any other reason to exist. They're just Beltway bandit firms that were smart enough to see that there was going to be a ton of money being distributed, and they decided to cash in.
When we say they were built strictly to get government contracts, are you saying that they don't produce anything, it's all a lie? Are you saying that their business model is the only income they're going to get is government contracts, but still, if they do the job well, they're, you know, giving a return on investment? What's your point about that?
That's true. You know, it's the latter description is the more accurate one. It's not that they necessarily don't do any work, and certainly some USAID money has been spent well. And I believe there are certainly, I'm sure, many employees of that agency who intend to do well. But the fact is that a lot of the money is wasted. And as you put it, it's the business model that's the issue. You know, they see, and this is not just, this is not strictly an issue of overseas development money. You see this in other sectors of the economy as well. But you see firms that recognize that large pots of money are available, and then they form around the goal of obtaining the government money and shape their agendas to do things and to carry out projects strictly so that they can get government funding. So that's the issue, as you described it.
Well, in the issue of fairness, we called USAID, and I'm not sure at least the press people that we spoke to were aware of your article. It is in the September issue of Harper, so I don't know if that's on the newsstand yet.
It's not on the newsstand.
So we got an advance copy, so maybe they know about it. But, you know, to try to craft a response to what they might say, I went to their website, and here are some statistics that they put forth. This is what they want the public to know, that their aid support and money is doing in Afghanistan. I'd like to have you talk about it. They say that today with USAID support, over 5.7 million students are enrolled in school, over five times more than in the Taliban era. Girls now comprise 35% of the total number of students enrolled, which is a higher percentage than any time in Afghan history. On the issue of roads, they say when USAID arrived in 2002, there were only 50 kilometers of intact paved roads. To date, USAID has built or rehabilitated 2,700 kilometers of roads, including 715 kilometers of the Ring Road, national highways, and provincial or rural roads. You want to talk about those stats at all?
Sure. I mean, I think it's lovely propaganda. I don't think it has any real bearing on reality. First off, they're saying, well, since the Taliban, well, that's great. But, you know, girls weren't allowed to go to school during the Taliban years. So, I mean, there are more, you know, by definition, you're going to have more girls in school. You also are going to have, you know, more schools. Fine. I mean, they've built some schools. They have definitely built some schools. It's just a question of how much money they've wasted. Let me just say that this is not just, you know, me deciding, oh, I don't like USAID. The Hillary Clinton, during her confirmation hearings, said of USAID that the agency had been decimated, that's her quote, and it's turned into more of a contracting agency than an operational agency with the ability to deliver. And if I can just also cite another expert here, John Mazurel, who was the former World Bank director in Afghanistan, said that in that country, quote, the wastage of aid is sky high. There is real looting going on, mainly by private enterprises. It's a scandal. In 30 years of my career, I've never seen anything like it. So there are a wide number of observers and experts who have looked at USAID's projects in Afghanistan and have concluded that they are very badly run and that a lot of money is being wasted. And when they talk about some of their specific projects, you know, they talk about aid for building roads. Well, it's, you know, they have spent a lot of money. 20% of all USAID funding for Afghanistan has been allocated to build roads. But this has really been very, very good for American companies who get the contracts, but not so great for Afghanistan. Let me just give you one example. The Lewis Berger Group was awarded, I think it was $7 million. Yes, $7 million to repair a road which had been built 30 years ago, and it runs from the airport to the city center in Kabul.
Mm-hmm.
This road, they ended up building it for $2.5 million per kilometer, which it turns out is about five times the average to build a road in Afghanistan in a very remote, difficult area. This is at the heart of the country, right from the airport into the center of Kabul. Overspending and misspending has been ridiculous, and you see this time and time again. It's the same with schools and clinics. Yes, they've built some schools and clinics. They've just spent far more than they should have, and the biggest beneficiaries are the American firms who are getting the contracts. It's not the people in Afghanistan.
The fact that American firms exist and they get contracts, some of these firms that you cite, I think the biggest one is called Chemonix. There's another one, Shelter for Life, a Christian nonprofit that got $7.6 million to build clinics and schools. Another one is called Voices for Humanity, developed audio programs in Afghanistan for non-literate people. Do you know any tangible results? Well, Chemonics has a $420 million contract, and they've tried to irrigate and eradicate opium. That hasn't worked. What about the smaller ones that you cite? Do you know what they do?
Well, some of these, you know, there was in 2004, there's a nonprofit group called Cooperative Housing Foundation International, and they won a contract to build 60 schools and clinics. And incidentally, all of those schools and clinics had actually been originally contracted to the Lewis Berger Group, but that original contract was annulled because there were so many delays and cost overruns. So then they awarded it to this new firm, CHF is the acronym. It was supposed to take them 6 months. Well, a year and a half later, they'd completed nine of the 60 buildings that they were contracted to do. So then they had to revoke that contract, and the USAID sent out an inspector general to review that program. But by the time they got there, this Cooperative Housing Foundation had closed down its offices in Afghanistan, so there was no one even to interview. And so, you know, once again, they had to revoke the contract, and they gave the remaining sites to another company called the International Organization for Migration. And they did. They did build. They did apparently complete the 60 schools and clinics in December of 2007. So yes, USAID succeeded here. I mean, if you want to say, well, they built the schools and clinics, that's great. They did. It's just that they did it very, very late. They blew a lot of money, and three different American firms profited very handily from this contract. And
yeah.
It's completely inefficient.
With some of these stories, you know, anecdotes are powerful. Maybe sometimes they don't tell the whole story, but there was an anecdote about one of the groups you cite, Voices for Humanity, where what they decided to do was to distribute iPods, essentially iPods,
mm-hmm.
personal
That's
music,
right.
MP3 players, pink for women, silver for men. They distributed 65,800 recorders, which cost $50 each. And someone pointed out that if they had just given the villages radios where everyone could listen to it once, it would save so much money. The point being was they weren't there to save money. They were there to get the contract and, you know, make as much money as they can. But, you know, in the article I read about the group, I mean, that seems ridiculous on its face, but the group did say that a radio could be, you know, tuned and controlled by one guy. If you have an iPod, you could go back and listen to it again and again. It's instructive. The people they gave it to seem to really like the iPods. They learn things on the iPods that they wouldn't have learned otherwise. So maybe there are two sides to this coin.
Well, you know, it seems to me that that project is fundamentally a waste of money. And, you know, I cannot say for sure. I have not been to the village, so I can't tell you that the iPods are no longer being used.
Have you been to Afghanistan?
No, I haven't. Mm-hmm. I have not been to Afghanistan. However, the piece I would point out is, you know, really it's about the Beltway bandits that are making money over there. And all of the anecdotes and stories I tell in this are very well documented. Many of them come from Inspector General reports issued by the USAID Inspector General. One thing I would point out about this firm that won the contract to distribute these iPods,
mm-hmm.
By the way, they were supposed to promote democracy in the run-up to the 2004 Afghan presidential election.
And it's clear that America has a certain candidate that it's backing, so
exactly.
Could be problematic, yes.
It could be problematic. But beyond that, I would note here that the company hired as a lobbyist the former chief of staff to Senator Mitch McConnell, who at the time chaired the Senate subcommittee that controlled funding for USAID. You see this also time and time again, where these firms that are getting the contracts are either founded by or headed by former senior USAID officials, or they hire lobbying firms that are very well connected with senators or congressmen who have access to USAID funding. It's you know, the Washington pork barrel. It's not development for Afghanistan. It's just the typical Washington pork barrel.
I want to ask you one last question about the presentation of the information. Harper's is famous for doing these annotations. They take a document and point to different lines. In the middle of this two-page spread is a map of Afghanistan, and, you know, you write a lot about it, pointed to different points on the map. But I was wondering why you felt that what you had lent itself to an annotation and not a, you know, 1,500-word article. If Harper's readers can't sit through that, what hope is there for, you know, real simple readers?
Well, you're asking a question really pretty much about editorial policy in a way, but fundamentally it's a really simple answer, which is that I'm working on another story that involved a lot of overseas travel and is taking up a lot of my time, and we didn't think it practical for me to do a second piece that took me to Afghanistan. And we thought that this story lent itself very well to the annotation format. We had this wonderful, colorful map that went back to 2002 at the dawn of the new age in Afghanistan, where the U.S. had was promising to rebuild the country. And, you know, again, President Bush talked about how we would develop it so it would never again be a safe haven for terrorism. And we just thought that, you know, you could tell this story very, very well in the annotation format. I would have loved to do, you know, a 5,000-word story and travel to Afghanistan. But you can't do every story you want to do, and we thought that this probably should be done shorter so that I could focus on another longer piece that involved a lot of travel.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us. Ken Silverstein, Washington editor for Harper's. Thank you very much, Ken.
Thank you.